The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with Kia Credit. Flexible 142 finance solutions from Kia, home of the 7-year warranty.
Text 51551. The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Michaela O'Donnell is originally from Tipperary.
And I never can forget the sweet maiden I met in the valley near Schliemnamon.
But she has become more associated in recent years with Donegal.
But if that girl I could hold, every raindrop would be gold. It could fall all around us on my Donegal shore.
Michaela O'Donnell, you're very welcome.
Good morning, John.
That put a smile on your face.
It did indeed, yeah. Yes. Good to be here.
Yeah, and congratulations, by the way, on the book, because it's the number one in the bestsellers list for non-fiction paperback. How does that feel?
Oh, my God. Unreal. I can't believe it. I'm delighted. Really, really chuffed.
And yeah. It's called It's All in the Head. And when, I think you were approached to write it.
I was, yes, absolutely.
Was it an easy book to write?
Once I sat down and started, it was. I mean, I really didn't think I had a book in me at all. You know, when they suggested it, they suggested I do a book about the cancer journey. And I said, no, I didn't think I had a book. You know, I just didn't have enough to talk about that. And so many people have done that anyway. But I, you know, when I, my bouts of depression, my battle with depression, and then my marriage breakdown and everything, and the work I did in myself, I thought, well, that might be a story. But I straight away thought, are you going to get a ghostwriter, like? And they said, well, why don't you give it a whirl? Try and write a few lines. And I did. And when I sat down, it just all poured out. It was like talking to somebody, telling a story.
Yeah, and I think you told Ryan Tubby recently that it just took 5 weeks to write.
Yeah, about five
from
weeks.
From start to finish.
Yeah.
Were you writing it longhand or were you writing it on a computer?
I just typed it, yeah.
And it all came flooding out.
Just flooding out. And literally one day, John, I was and I just stopped dead. And I said, that's it. I've nothing else to say. And I couldn't even go back to try and make sense of what I'd done. It was like a blurt out. And then I said, no, I'll let the publishers now see, you know, what sorting needs to be done. But I had it in chapters at that stage. Don't get me wrong. I knew when I sat down, I said, right, I'll do something on Daniel and I'll do something on my marriage and my parents and my cancer. So I had it all sectioned and then once I'd started writing, that was it.
That was it. It just came flowing out with no difficulty at all. You'll probably have another book in you soon.
Well, I don't know about that.
And I'm just wondering, though, is it important for you, because a lot of people know you as Daniel O'Donnell's wife, is it very important to you to have your own life and career?
I was very happy being Daniel O'Donnell's wife. I didn't mind. You know, it just amazed me, really. It's since the head shave is when people have kind of got to know me, or would I say the people now that know me aren't Daniel O'Donnell fans just. I've kind of got people...
Your own following.
Yeah, I suppose, who've admired what I've done or whatever, which is fantastic. But totally unexpected, and it's amazing what's happened in the last year.
Yes, indeed. And we can go back now. You mentioned the head shave and remind ourselves of that night and the late late.
You feel it? How does it feel?
Oh, wow.
Strange?
It's fab.
Fab! Yes, that's fab! That's for sure. Okay. Sinead O'Connor, eat your heart out as you're walking.
Yes, and you write. You start at that point in the book, the build up, this sort of eureka moment when
it was funny, because when I was writing the book, I thought, now if I went into a bookshop and I opened, I'm not a great reader, I have to say, I opened a book. I really do. I look at the first chapter and I look at maybe the preface or whatever, and I say, so I thought, I've got to get something that's going to grab people first, and a lot of people had seen that, so they're going to think, oh gosh, yeah, what. So I thought that's where I'd start, and then I went back.
Yeah, and you recall it, but there was just a steely determination. You were going to do this, and even I think one of the researchers on The Late Late said, well, you can do it during the break or go off and get it done. You said, no, I want this live.
Absolutely, yeah.
Live and in front of
the
public.
When I contacted them, actually, I wanted the head shave. I actually didn't want to do an interview because I didn't want it to be about me. I just wanted to do the head shave for the charity, for awareness and everything. And when I was talking to the researcher, I suggested, and he came back and he said, yeah, we'd be glad to do an interview. And I said, no, it's not an interview. I said, I want to do my head shave. And he said, you mean you actually want to shave your head on the... And I said, yeah. I said, I don't really want to do the interview. So he went away and he came back and he said, no, we have to do an interview. And now I'm really glad, because that, I think a lot of people said, was... How you accepted the head shave. I think the head shave on its own would have been a bit stark, you know.
Yes, no. It was a great thing to do, and it was, watching it even now, there's a great sense of, you accepting what you're going through, but also giving people the reassurance that, because a lot of people will have to go through it.
Absolutely,
as part of their journey with cancer.
I suppose I was trying to normalise it as much as I could as well, so there's somebody that maybe... knew they were facing that, could literally sit. I mean, how many of us have sat and watch a cancer patient have their head shaved? And you'd be wondering what. So I thought, well, if they see it,
it normalises a bit, as you say. And what about your cancer? How are you, Majella?
I'm great, thank God. Yeah, I'm on 4 monthly checkups now, and I'm clear. And I finished my last reconstruction 3 weeks ago, so I'm feeling very feminine again and quite happy with everything. So, yeah, no, I'm great.
And that part of it, was it difficult? The reconstruction?
Oh, no, not really. No, I say that. I'm a bit of a toughie. I don't know where I got it from or what, but I just consider myself really lucky, John, that I had something I could cut off. It wasn't a lung, it wasn't kidneys, it wasn't, I'm very lucky in that respect. I didn't need my breast to live. And I knew that, with the reconstruction, as long as I have a shape, a womanly shape or whatever, I know I'm a woman. I don't, the fact that the real ones are gone, it doesn't really bother me.
But some people say some people who have had breast cancer find it all a bit harrowing, the sheer physical nature of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly when you wake up after the mastectomy, it is not a pretty sight. But then you have to say to yourself, well, I'm doing this for myself. I'm doing this so that my chances of cancer coming back are reduced, even though, and I'll be real clear, they did say to me that that's not necessarily the case. You could have just had the chemo and your lumpectomy, radiation. I chose the mastectomies because for me mentally, I knew I would feel better if I didn't have to worry about the breasts at all.
But it was your choice, though.
It was my choice. I was lucky. You see, this is it. Some women have no choice. Mm. I did have a choice, and that was the road I went down, because I felt, even if it was, I know they say, the chances are minimal. I don't care if it's 0.25% more. That 0.25% might save my life. So that's why I... opted.
And did your doctor say to you, you don't need to do this, they ask you to reconsider?
They took a while. As soon as I was diagnosed, I said I want a mastectomy, and the doctor said, whoa, hang on a second.
Slow down,
we need to have a lumpectomy. And I said, but I don't want it. I'd had lots of lumps in the past. Well, maybe 4 or 5 since my 20s, and they'd all been cysts or benign. And I'd always said, if one of them is ever cancer, I'm going to have a mastectomy. I am. So, of course, the minute he said it's cancer, I said, mastectomy. He said, no, you need to slow down. We need to do a lumpectomy. I said, but I want a mastectomy. But you don't need it. I said, for myself, I need it. He said, well, if we do that, if we just do a mastectomy, he said, and your cancer is really bad, that's going to affect your treatment. It's going to slow the treatment down. We need to do the lumpectomy, take out the cancer, look at it, see what it is, what kind of cancer is it, what treatment you need. Do that. Then if you need the mastectomy, you can, which I totally got. But it took me a while to get that.
But they eventually were persuaded by your own argument.
Well, they said to me, once you do all your treatment and everything, if the mastectomy is still something you feel you really, really need, then we'll do it. And that's...
And you're looking great.
Thank you.
And the hair has grown back.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering then, do you enjoy good health all along, these regular checkups? Are you confident that you've won the battle?
Yeah, for some reason or other, I feel it's done and dusted. I really do. I kind of think, I've got it, dealt with it, bumps gone, it's in the past, it's not. I feel I've actually really got something out of it. Mm. My life has improved, I suppose, mentally. My attitude is even better now because I'm so grateful for everything that happens. I'm grateful for every day. I've had a brilliant year, considering my last year was absolutely rubbish.
Horrific.
And I'm having a great year now. But funnily enough, at the back of my head, I do kind of think it might come back someday, but it's not worrying me, you know. I'm going to wait. Not wait for it. No, that sounds wrong. I'm going to take each day as it comes. If it happens, the way I feel is if it comes back, it comes back. And I'll deal with it then. I'm not worrying about it in the meantime. I'm not obsessing it at all. But no, I don't think. I think I've beaten it. Please God.
Please God. Fingers crossed. Yeah. The book, you write about a number of things in the book about relationships with your dad, relationships with Raymond, your former husband, and then with Daniel. The account of your marital breakdown is searingly honest. You don't, there's not very little waffle in there. You're talking about the difficulties that you experienced, and it just hit me that that part of it must have been difficult to write, because I think you sort of say to yourself that even though you knew that your former husband was carrying on, that you still wanted him back, and there was still intimacy at a stage when, you know, there was a bit of you saying, God, this is never going to work.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I suppose when I was writing the book, the chapter that I found the most difficult was the one about my dad, because it was so recent, with him dying, I mean. Mm-hmm. With Raymond and my marriage, because I had done so much work, because I'd been through so much turmoil during that times he was having the affairs, and I was taking him back, and we'd split up and we'd be back and la-la-la. And then I started to see psychologists and reading books and everything. I really kind of started to look at my own, I suppose, take responsibility for my own, for myself, for my own actions. I remember one psychologist said to me, she said, Majelle, you know, you're like a butterfly on the backside of an elephant. All you have to do is fly off. You know, you don't have to stay there and complain and be miserable, and you just need to take responsibility for yourself and go, you know what I mean? I know I'm not suggesting it's easy. I had two children, I didn't have anything, but you can do it. And I just learned that I had to say, look, I can't be dependent on him to make me happy. I can't depend on him anymore to be to be my husband, to support us and everything, because he's off here, there and everywhere. So I need to take responsibility. So when I went to do the book, I dealt with it all. It was easy enough to write out. Because I'd dealt with it all, and I'd been through the roller coaster. I'd been through the crying and the tears, and I'll never be in that place again. No matter whatever happens to me in my life,
I will never be as bad as I was when my husband because you write about the fact, I think it's the day you bring home Michael and he's nowhere to be seen, Raymond, your former husband, that it turns out that he was with his lover that first night that you came home.
The first night, yeah, we came home, yeah. No, it does kind of, before it used to hurt like a knife. Now I just kind of think, God, you must have been some guy to do that. You know? Now, don't get me wrong, we have a fine relationship now. We get on grand. But I just had a cesarean as well. Siobhan was 3, 2 and a half. Michael's a baby. First night home, I'm going out to wet the baby's head. I didn't see him till 2 o'clock the next afternoon. I was out of my mind with worry, thinking he was dead somewhere in a ditch. He'd been with her.
And how soon? Because you didn't know at the time.
He was, Michael then was 6 months old when I realised he'd been having an affair while I was pregnant and everything. You know, it had been going on for a while. So
other women might find it very difficult to forgive somebody who did all of that, but not you.
That's how weak I was, John, though, as a person. That's how desperate is the word, actually, I was. I was desperate. I was so terrified of being on my own that I was willing to put up with that. I remember when I got married first, I always thought I'd give any man one chance. I would. Any man. We're all human. We make mistakes. Man might go out and have a one-night stand. It would hurt like hell, but I know I could forgive him. But what I did was I forgave him the first, and then I just, that was my boundary. And then he stepped over that boundary, so I pushed it further back. And then he stepped over that boundary. And in the end, I had no boundaries at all. So he was walking all over me, you know. So I just had to kind of say to myself, I had to learn to have self-respect, to be honest with you, and say, no, I shouldn't be letting somebody do this. I don't need him in my life. I thought I did. And it took me a long time.
How long did it take, actually?
About 3 or 4 years.
To realise?
To give up on him.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
after we'd split up, to say that he's not going to be. Because when I got married, it was so important to me. I wanted to grow old with the father of my children. I love Daniel to bits. He's my soulmate. And my life is so much more enriched. I never knew what a healthy relationship was until I met Daniel. But I still would like to be with the father of my children.
Mm.
Now, I can't say I wish Daniel was the father of my children because my children wouldn't be who they are.
Sure.
And I certainly don't want to be with my ex-husband. But you know what I'm trying to say?
Yes. That was the way you thought things would evolve.
Evolve, yeah. I wanted to be at my children's wedding with my husband, with their father together, grow old, have our children visiting. It's not this, oh, well, you know, he's got another wife and other children and I've got Daniel and weddings and da da. I just really wanted the traditional thing. But anyway, there we go. You know, you
so is there
choose
regret,
a path.
Is there an element of regret there?
Well, I can't regret because I did my best.
Mm-hmm.
So what can I what can I do? You know, I have two beautiful children and maybe he's the one that should regret. Well, he should definitely regret. He should definitely regret.
All
he missed out on the terrible.
All the things he did. And you obviously then...
No, I didn't mean that. I meant he should regret that he's still not with me.
I see. Yes, yes. And Magella, then you talk in the book then about the meeting Daniel at your parents' pub in Tenerife, but you also make it clear that at one stage in your sort of fledgling relationship with Daniel, he went a bit cool on you.
He certainly did, yeah.
And why so?
I suppose my where I was in my life, being divorced, having two children, just didn't kind of sit with his Catholic ethos the way he just didn't see himself being in a situation like that. And I suppose he thought, oh, God, no, I don't know about this now. You know, Daniel's very private, far more. I mean, I am literally an open book. Daniel is a very private person. And I suppose he knew the papers would go to town. Oh, my God, Daniel O'Donnell marrying a divorcee and blah, blah, blah. And I think he probably just had to have time out to think about that. But he said when, you know, we were still friends, we were still talking. But he said that, you know, he kept thinking about me when he'd be in places at shows or whatever. He'd kind of think, God, Michelle, why am I thinking about her all the time? And then he thought, look, if I'm sure God wouldn't deny me love that I found, you know, this is the person I want to be with. And we'll just have to forge ahead and get through whatever we need to get through to make it work. And thank God he did, and we did. And
got back together. And then, of course, you talk about the wedding, but also you also sought an annulment of your marriage.
Mm.
And when you sought that first day, did you expect the outcome? Did you expect to get it?
Yeah, I didn't really know what the process would be, I suppose. And, you know, I didn't. It was a reasonably straightforward case, my case was, and the reason being that Raymond had been with somebody the night before the wedding. And the best man knew this, and the best man was kind of saying to him, you know, Raymond, are you sure you want to do this, you know? And he just said, sure, if it doesn't work out, I'll divorce her, you know, it's no big deal. And that really was the crux of me getting the annulment. It was kind of like a very clear-cut case in, you know, with the canon lawyers, because the if you like, the contract was never deemed.
So he broke the contract before it began.
Exactly.
So he was with somebody the night before he got married.
Yeah.
And when did that emerge? When did you find out?
That was, you know, I suppose, I don't really know, maybe after, well, I knew the marriage was over before I found that out.
Right.
You know, but...
So this was like, part of the case that you had to build.
Exactly. If a man marries a woman and fully intends, you know, loves her, wants it to work, a year down the road, he ends up having an affair with somebody. That's not the same.
Mm.
It's not the same, because when he went into the marriage, he fully intended it to work. Raymond didn't. Now, when you're going through annulments as well, there's an awful lot of people interviewed, like the best man was interviewed, who Raymond had kind of lost contact with because they just fell out with the whole thing. And he was interviewed and Raymond was interviewed and his parents and my parents and witnesses. You know, there was a lot of people interviewed over time, and they just realised that, you know, yeah, this guy had no intentions of staying married. So there was never a contract, really. I didn't know that's how it works.
And they were the grounds for the annulment.
They were the grounds.
It would have required then Raymond to have been very honest.
Yeah, thank God he was. He's a decent guy.
Mm.
He just likes to be with other women. What can I say?
Yes.
But so, he is a good...
So when the canon lawyer went to talk to him, he admitted that he'd been with somebody the night before the wedding,
he
had never intended for it to be forever.
Absolutely,
And were you surprised then when you got the annulment?
Oh, I was delighted, I mean, I just didn't... You know, they kind of said, well, we'll be honest with you, it was a very straightforward case. And I just thought, wow, that's fantastic. Because as I said, I didn't know that... I didn't think about that, this not going into the contract, but delighted, absolutely delighted for Daniel.
Yes.
I wouldn't have cared.
Where
because
you got
to
married.
Me, I walked down the aisle, I gave my vows, I said to God, I wanted this, la la la, and look where it left me. Mm. You know, I ended up being on my own. So to me, having God's blessing is really important to me, don't get me wrong. I'm talking about the big wedding thing. That's the church, loads of people, the reception. I would have been happy to do it quietly. But of course, that was really, really important to Daniel. And I was so pleased for him, you know. And I was happy that I was able to get God's blessing again because I meant it, you know. I wanted it to last forever. So
Yes, indeed. And you hit me as somebody who's in great form and well able to deal with what's coming her way. But you've spoken, even before there was the focus on your cancer, you've spoken about your depression and you speak about it in the book and about the fact that you have to manage it, that you don't take it for granted.
Yep, absolutely, I do. I kind of keep my eye out for it. I'm aware of it because I can feel it coming. I know, you know, times of it coming, I can get very agitated. I know that I have to, like even at the moment now when I'm going all the time, that this is the kind of time I have to be wary because I need a lot of sleep. If I get tired, that's sometimes when I can start to go down. So I need to kind of switch off. If I feel it coming, I need to switch off. I need to stay at home. I need to rest. I need to sleep. Then I might try and I go out for walks and just kind of get very much back in touch with nature and get away from all the buzz. But I will say, John, and this is purely my opinion and my experience and my journey, cancer was an awful lot worse for me than depression is an awful lot worse for me than the cancer journey. An awful lot worse.
Why?
Because cancer, you can visualise, cancer is a thing. Cancer is it's a tumour, it's a lump. There are cells that are growing. So therefore, you can visualise them. You can zap them with radiation. You can cut them out. You can, you know, take your chemo. People know what it's all about. They're all lined up there waiting to sort you out and you're sent in this direction and that for MRIs and scans and everything. When you have depression, nobody can put their finger on it. Even the professionals find it hard. Still so much work has to be done in the mental health. You know, I just think it's shocking that there isn't like an emergency department for somebody that's hit with depression, because that's when you need to see somebody, is when you go down now. Mm. Not go to your doctor and be told you have an appointment with a psychiatrist in 6 months, because that might be too late. You know, it's now you need the help. And I so wish that we could get some sort of a facility going that people could go in now and talk and say, my God, I'm in this desperate hole. Please talk to me.
And there are services available to people who feel, you know, that they're low in themselves and they need some help. But you're trying to establish one in Donegal as well. That's one of your projects.
Absolutely, yeah. I have, I'm launching it now in December. My own charity will be called Donegal Mind Wellness DMW. And I'm fundraising for that. And what we're doing is we're setting up courses, the 6-week course called Stress Management. And you go one night a week. And we're doing it all in small towns around Donegal. What I'm trying to do is access people up that mountain in wherever, Buncrana or Inishbofin or Dunloe or whatever, where it's very set aside, if you like, or there aren't many facilities, and give them the opportunity to come and go to this course where they do not have to open their mouths. That's the really important thing, because some people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about their... So they just come, they can just sit there. If it's not for them, they get up and leave. It's free. We have facilitators that are doing it voluntarily. And it's to give people the tools to try and deal with depression anxiety, stress. As I said, it's called stress management. That all leads to depression. Great. So,
well, good luck with the launch of that.
Thank you, Jim.
And thanks a million for coming in this morning to talk to us, Magella.
Thank you.
And continued success with the book. It's called It's All in the Head. And as I said at the outset, it's top of the bestsellers list in the non-fiction paperback category. Thanks very much,
thanks
Magella.
Thanks a million, John.
Take
care.
Thank you.
Text 51551. The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1.